It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm not sure what the normal format is, but this is going to be a chalk talk. So hopefully that'll facilitate discussions, interactions, and we'll see how it goes. So I wanted to start off with a few introductory remarks. And I think one of the questions that, or one of the theories that really has defined the field of population genetics and molecular evolution is the neutral theory of molecular evolution, which I'm sure many of you know, but it simply states that the vast majority of changes that occur during evolution at the molecular level, DNA sequence changes, are neutral and don't affect fitness. And so this theory has it's really been a paradigm for understanding patterns and levels of variation within and between species, and one way or another, most people's work is either directly or indirectly related to this. And there have been significant challenges, and there have been long debates. I think Marty Kreitman wrote an article one time entitled "The Neutral Theory is Dead, Long Live the Neutral Theory." So just the debate continues and will continue. But one of the things that I think is quite important is that many of the sort of relationships between the theoretical models on the theoretical side and the empirical side join for intersect in protein coding sequences. So a lot of the statistical models and methods that have been used are for coding sequences. But a lot of functional sequences in the genome are non-coding. I think one could argue that as it stands currently, or at least the majority of the data speak to coding sequences, and that our understanding of regulatory sequences in non-regions of the genome that do not code for protein sequences, we don't really know how well they fit a neutral model or not. So, with that, the title of what I wanted to talk about today is evolution of cis-regulatory sequences. And then particularly really what I wanted to talk about is the intersection between the theory and the data. And I think there is, it's one of the things that originally attracted me to population genetics is in biology, I think it's one of the fields that has the closest connections between precise, exact quantitative models and empirical data. So, I mean, all biology has models, but in population genetics, they are, at least under certain conditions, exact quantitative predictions of what you'd expect under certain conditions. So, before going into the discussion of cis-regulatory sequences and their evolution, there's a couple comments I'd like to make about the relationship between theory and data for coding sequences. And this involves the McDonald-Kreitman test. So I don't want to go through the sort of the whole basis for this test, but it's just generally speaking, it's a comparison of polymorphism and divergence in protein coding sequences, and it's a test of the neutral theory, so it can provide evidence for positive selection acting on protein coding sequences driving amino acid divergence. So the reason why this is why I wanted to bring this up is because in recent years there's been a number of pieces of data that have been quite provocative. And that is, in Drosophila, the numbers are about 30 to 70% of amino acid substitutions that occur during evolution have been driven by positive selection. So this is obviously not within the realm of the neutral theory, which says that it's, you know, less than 1%. However, the numbers are less than 1% if you look at data in yeast, humans, or plants. So, in one sense, this doesn't really make sense, because if this test has the ability to detect positive selection, and positive selection is really common across all organisms, or it is really common, then you should see it across all organisms. So the fact that there is abundant evidence by this test for positive selection in one species but not in other species raises some questions. So there has been a lot of work to sort of refining these numbers, but I think the reason that I bring this up now is because you have a theory and you have some empirical data that says that your theory is wrong. One is to just collect more empirical data and look at the distribution, look at more species and everything else, but another thing is to go back and say, well, maybe our theoretical model is wrong. And it might be time to, and I think this is a good motivation for doing this. In other words, coming up with a neutral theory that can explain a significant McDonald-Kreitman test. So I wouldn't say this if there wasn't already some theory that, or some theoretical models that can explain this. So there was a recent paper by Huerta Sanchez et al. In 2008. This is from Carlos Bustamante's group at Cornell. And there's been, what they do is they look at fluctuating selection. And actually, Kimura, in the 50s, when he was looking at diffusion approximations and developing the analytic theory for a Wright-Fisher model of genetic drift, mutation and genetic drift, very early on considered fluctuating selection as an important parameter to consider in these models. And there's been theoretical work done in the 60s and in the 70s and in the 80s on fluctuating selection and its impact on polymorphism and divergence. And so really what this paper does is put it in the context of the McDonald-Kreitman test. And what they show is that if you have fluctuating selection such that the average selection coefficient is zero, but it changes either from one generation to the next, or it can be temporal variation, so some individuals have positive, some have negative selection coefficients, that that you get a significant McDonnell-Kreitman test. So you can use the data, polymorphism divergence data, that's analyzed by a McDonnell-Kreitman test and estimate the strength of fluctuating selection on a very short time scale. So I think it, more on a philosophical level, the question is whether fluctuating selection if that is within the realm of a neutral model or not. And so on the one hand, you can say, well, if the average selection coefficient is zero, then is that really adaptation? It's just sort of, you know, sometimes it's good to be tall, sometimes it's good to be short. And so if there's no real change in phenotype, it just sort of continually varies. There isn't really any adaptation, despite the fact that there's a considerable number of changes that both increase and decrease the phenotype and during evolution. And so I guess this is I'd like to throw one more idea out onto this relationship, which is that despite the fact that the test indicates significant evidence for positive selection, and there is some theoretical models that can look at fluctuating selection, another model for which that I don't, another sort of theoretical consideration that hasn't been sort of explicitly formulated is the assumption of independence among sites. So pretty much every model in molecular evolution, except for the covariant model, for which it's very difficult to work in, assume independence among sites. And we know that that's not true. I think the reason why it hasn't been incorporated is because we don't know how to incorporate something unless we know what the parameters are for the model. So how do you model independence among sites? And there have been, I mean, there have been some ideas, but without sort of, you know, a specific set of data that will provide guidance to how you would set up the non-independence among sites, it's difficult to incorporate and to test empirically and develop the theory for. So I think one really important question is whether independence among sites can explain observations like this. And in some sense, fluctuating selection, although in this context it was formulated in the case where the environment causes fluctuating selection coefficients, the genetic background at a particular site, the genetic background can also vary. So from one generation, you're in one individual, you have a certain genetic background. In the next generation, you're in another individual, you have a different genetic background. Those changes in the genetic background can cause a change in the selected advantage or disadvantage of that particular allele. So it's not implausible to also consider fluctuating selection as a consequence of the genetic background in addition to the environmental background.
Are the patients are assumed to fluctuate on the scale of generation time in this world.
The selection coefficients on the order of a single generation, although there are theoretical models where that assumption is relaxed and there's assumed to be a decay, a correlation from one generation to the next, and there's a parameter that controls how long that correlation exists. And they give similar results, but that's something that has been incorporated from the standpoint of the diffusion approximations.
But I mean the notion of adaptation depends largely on what time scale you assume. I mean, fluctuating from one generation to another doesn't allow for anything like adaptation, while fluctuation on a much larger timescale does allow for adaptation, right? I mean,
Certainly. So, yeah, over. I agree. The question of, you know, when is it really considered an adaptation? Over a long time scale, you can have enough changes in one direction that you actually are getting a change in the phenotype or some function. But on a short time period, that won't happen.
So adaptation, you define as a significant, like a observable change in the phenotype, or as a fixation of the gene, like on the molecular level, in the right direction. So, I mean.
I don't know. What would Darwin say, right?
Darwin didn't know about any molecular basis.
So,
I don't know.
In some sense, so for example, models of host pathogen interactions where you evolve resistance and virulence, and resistance and virulence is fits with sort of the Red Queen hypothesis, where, you know, in order to just stay where you are, in order to survive, you have to keep evolving continuously, otherwise you get wiped out. And generally, I think that's considered adaptation, because if you don't adapt, then you've lost the evolutionary race. So I think it depends on the context in which, you know, in which it's raised. But we do know that there are a lot of traits that are under purifying selection. And the optimum is in the middle. And I think the question is, for all of the genes that contribute to these traits, where the trait mean is not changing, but there are plus and minus alleles for that trait that are going to fixation, is that really considered adaptation or not? And I would say there's at least enough examples where probably not.
So the time scale for these fluctuation events turns out to be crucial. And if you have very slow fluctuations, which actually then happen at time scales which are shorter than longer than substitution events, you can't anymore use diffusion theory to address this. And all this diffusion thing holds only for fluctuations that happen at a time scale of few generations, where this is the lifetime of polymorphism, so up to n. And at that limit, you won't have any sustained movement in your fitness. So you will have a surplus of substitutions, which is what this Bustamante paper is doing. And that is then confounding the McDonald-Crichton test. But you don't have substitutions that go to the direction of the selection. So in that sense, the adaptation dies out with that regime. But when you have these very long-term fluctuations that are slow, then you can make these adaptive substitutions. And this is actually what we looked with Michael in this Drosophila thing as an explanation for the polymorphism spectrum. So it's the long-term fluctuations that then the genome has time to adapt.
Yeah, so do you think that it's possible to distinguish between look at empirical data and distinguish whether the, you know, sort of McDonald-Crichton type of data is better explained by a short-term or a long-term fluctuation?
Well, you need to have the spectrum. So McDonald-Crichton data, by definition, it integrates over the spectrum and takes just a number of polymorphisms. So at that level, that test obviously can't do that.
But even with the spectrum, do you think that it would be possible to distinguish short-term fluctuations and the very long-term fluctuations?
If you give a different spectrum.
Hopefully different enough that it can be detected with a reasonable amount of data.
This one needs to check because you obviously, as you know, the substitution numbers are the big ones. So if you do a consistent analysis, then the spectrum is not, you have always just mu times n number of events in the spectrum. So it doesn't then provide that much evidence.
but yes, you could, if you have enough data, you can.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think now with genome polymorphism data, you get the entire genome with multiple individuals sequenced, there will definitely be very large data sets, and hopefully that'll be something that can look at. But I mean, on a more biological level, there is no, I mean, I haven't heard of any good ideas that explain the difference between Drosophila and these other organisms. If you exclude human,
Can I just add one more comment?
Sure.
So with this quickly fluctuating thing that Bustamante is proposing, then you can see that other people like Petrov have found these sweeps going through the genome. So that is in some sense not compatible with these quick fluctuations. So I think in Drosophila, the evidence is actually there.
Right. So that's true. I mean, so one of the, for the neutral theory, selective sweeps and hitchhiking events are one area where people have spent a lot of time looking at whether the neutral theory can account for that. And that's definitely an area this type of fluctuating selection is not going to produce any sort of hitchhiking or selective sweep events. And in addition, the hitchhiking and selective sweeps don't care whether you're encoding or non-coding sequences. I mean, they influence linked neutral variation around the site. The site can be anywhere. And so in some sense, that is an unbiased way at testing the neutral theory, whereas other ways where you specifically look in coding sequences are really just answering the question for coding sequences. But I guess the question there is how much of hitchhiking is actually related to the sort of excess, the large amount of divergence indicated by a McDonald-Kreitman type of test. So some of it will be related, but some of it might not. I mean, a single strongly selected site can eliminate all of the variation from a region of low recombination and cause a huge deviation from what you'd expect, and that's just one substitution. I think one of the things that's really disturbing about this is that this is sort of, you know, averaged across all proteins, and so, you know, saying that polymerases, 50% of changes in polymerases have been adaptive, I mean, polymerases are shared by every organism. They do the same thing. I mean, what are they adapting to? I mean, you think that they would have reached an optimum. It's possible that they could be, you know, some shift in nucleotide composition or something like that. But it becomes more and more difficult to make a story or provide a reasonable explanation for, you know, the majority of proteins in the genome. So, those are some introductory remarks, and then I guess. A few other things. I just wanted to give a couple sort of general areas on theoretical models of evolution. Just as a way of introduction. So people develop models for phenotype. And genotype, and then in some cases have combined these and both look at phenotype and genotype at the same time. So just to give some examples, Russ Landy has some nice theoretical work where you have a trait that's determined by and basically an infinite number of very small affect loci. And each and what that allows you to use is a Gaussian approximation, and with that particular relationship you can model the evolution of this phenotype in a phylogenetic context, that's been and actually come up with a neutral, there is a neutral theory for phenotypic evolution based on this theoretical work of for specific types of phenotypes, so it's not for phenotypes that are caused by one or a small number of genes. And then models for genotype, these are the ones perhaps many of you are familiar with from Kimura, where you're looking at the substitution rate within and between species, and they are very exact, and they don't depend on a lot of things because mutations are random, and when those are random it becomes very easy to model those statistically. But I think one of the areas that could really see some additional development is models that incorporate both genotype and phenotype. And particularly, I think the case where this is important is if you want to incorporate non-independence among sites. If there is non-independence among sites, it's got to be because of phenotype. Because if you're an A at a particular position, the only way that you know that having a G or an A at another position depends on what changes your fitness is got to be by some phenotype. Mutations are random, and if you don't have any phenotype or selection, then there's no way to get there are few ways to get dependent among sites in terms of the evolution. And there's a number of cases where we know where the genotype depends on the phenotype. Probably the example that I'd like to talk about today is in transcription factor binding sites, where it's definitely true that that a substitution or a nucleotide change at one position depends on adjacent nearby sites and violates all of the modeling assumptions that most of us use. Okay, so to start off the discussion on the evolution of cis-regulatory sequences, it really starts with a debate of whether evolution occurs mostly in protein coding sequences or non-coding cis-regulatory sequences. And a lot of the debate's been going along for a long time now, I think a lot of the initial evidence was pretty much a matter of saying, well, proteins are mostly conserved, and all closely related organisms have the same set of proteins. So if you want to explain why animals are different or different organisms are different from one another, it's obviously due to the fact that they're regulated differently. And so that's sort of an argument based on what we know. Of course, what we don't know is whether the genes are regulated differently, and the sequences that control that regulation, how did they evolve? Have they been evolving under positive selection or not? And so there's, traditionally there's a number of ways to look at evolution of protein, and now that there's genome information at non-coding sequences as well. And so first off, looking across multiple genomes, one can compare the presence or absence of proteins, one can compare the presence and absence of six regulatory sequences, and just ask whether those two, whether you're more often evolving new proteins or more often evolving new regulatory sequences. Alternatively, you can also have evolution where you're not really getting a binary on-off. You're not losing and gaining whole proteins and whole regulatory sequences. You're actually modifying the function of those regulatory sequences or those protein coding sequences, in which case you're really looking at the rate of evolution for those sequences. So both of these types of, you know, presence, absence, and rate of evolution have been applied extensively to protein coding sequences, but it's been difficult to do that for regulatory sequences because we don't know where regulatory sequences are, both from an empirical-based approach of finding them, but also from more sort of computational approaches. So for example, for coding sequences, there's a number of very excellent ways of defining where proteins are and what sequences encode for proteins in the genome. Ab initio gene prediction, you don't need to use anything else, that works really well. You can also look at ESTs. For regulatory sequences, that's not the case. So without knowing where regulatory sequences are, it's impossible to know how often they are shared across multiple organisms or how often they've diverged in function. Evolutionary biologists are not the only ones interested in identifying all of the regulatory sequences in the genome. This is a very large topic and something that a lot of people are interested in. One of the primary means of doing that has been comparative genomics. And the idea is really quite simple. You sequence a whole bunch of genomes and you look for non-coding sequences that are conserved across multiple genomes. And the fact that these non-coding sequences are conserved across genomes implies that they have some sort of fitness effect, and presumably most functional non-coding sequences are involved in gene regulation. This has turned out to work pretty well in that if you look at cis regulatory sequences that have been mapped experimentally, in many cases they're conserved across species. Of course, in terms of understanding the evolution of coding versus non-coding sequences, this is circular because you're requiring the fact that it's conserved, you can't then use those things that are conserved and look at how they evolve. Or you have to do some sort of you have to somehow take that into account. At least with the comparative genomics method, assuming that the regulatory sequences are somewhat conserved in all species, you can still look at the evolution within those species. But there's a further problem to doing this, which is a very interesting set of observations that have been made. Generally speaking, divergence in sequence is not equal to divergence in function. Although there is a relationship between conservation of sequence and conservation of function, and divergence in sequence and divergence in function, there are some very compelling examples of cis regulatory sequences that
do the same exact thing, but are and show no sequence similarity. So if you can find a way to relate two sequences that have the same function to one another, then you actually understand gene regulation, which would be a very significant accomplishment. So provide.
Just to provide an example of the type of studies. So there's a couple of studies in the early 80s, then there were some in the 90s. I think the number of examples is growing, although providing sort of nice concrete examples is not an easy thing, but it's not difficult to suppose that that this occurs commonly. In other words, that you have a lot of divergence in sequence, but no divergence in function. So the example that that I'll refer to is a study by Ratten et al. I think it's in 2006. And this is from Gabrielle Dover's lab. They have a couple of other examples. This is one that this is a particularly nice one where they looked at a talus enhancer that had been mapped in Drosophila melanogaster, and this is about I think something around a 2 kb chunk of DNA. And if you take this piece of DNA and hook it up to a reporter, you get a particular spatial and temporal pattern of expression that occurs during development in embryogenesis. You get expression at the beginning, at the anterior and posterior end of the organism. If you look at the talus gene is also conserved to housefly. And if you take that same, 2 kb region upstream of the gene and you put it in Drosophila melanogaster, you get the same exact pattern. So you get these two sequences that show the same exact pattern. However, even if you force an alignment, there is no sequence similarity. If you look for transcription factor binding sites, of course, there's tons of them because transcription factor binding sites are found all over sequences that look like transcription factor binding sites are found everywhere. So there's no good alignment between these two sequences, yet they drive the same pattern of evolution. So the the model for this is binding site turnover, just to simply describe, if you have a regulatory sequence with a transcription factor binding site, and then another site pops up just by chance, you have two of them, and if they're functionally redundant, then it doesn't matter which one you lose, and so you go from having a site here to having a site here. When you compare these two sequences, let's say that, here's the, this is from this species, this is from this species, all of a sudden there's no sequence homology, or that the function has been transferred from this position to this position. And so that would explain, in this case, for this example of the talus gene, they actually know where the transcription factors that drive this particular pattern, they know where they are. And they actually did some work to find those in the other species. And so the model that they put forward is that these binding sites have just switched the position, orientation, and order in the regulatory sequence, so that if those two things don't matter, all you have to do is wait long enough, and with a model like this, where you have gain and loss of gain, redundancy, and followed by loss, you can get sequences that don't look anything like each other, but do have the same function. Okay. So, I guess here's a simple model for evolution of regulatory sequences. Is there data that supports this model? So one piece of data that people have collected is looking at experimentally identified sites or sequences. And so the idea is really very simple. You go, I mean, experimentally identifying regulatory sequence is not easy. It takes a lot of effort just to identify one region or one particular binding site. But a number of examples have accumulated in literature, and so you can just go to an experimentally identified site and just ask whether the thing is conserved across multiple species. There is a, and when people do this, you find that they aren't always conserved. However, there's a problem to this, and I think it's particularly for examples like, one way of experimentally identifying a large number of binding sites across the genome is through chip-chip experiments, where all of the positions in a genome where a transcription factor, all of the sequences where a transcription factor binds are mapped experimentally. So then you could go and say, okay, I've got the 200 or 500 positions where this transcription factor binds. Are those in conserved positions? And a lot of times they aren't. However, the fact that a transcription factor binds a sequence doesn't mean that that binding means anything. In other words, there might be lots of positions in the genome where a transcription factor binds, and it doesn't matter if it binds, it doesn't matter if it doesn't bind. And that's why they aren't conserved, because eliminating those binding sites has no impact on fitness. Although some of the experimentally identified sites, you can be confident that eliminating those sites affects the phenotype or the fitness of the organism, there are lots of other examples where even if the transcription factor binds a site and that binding affects the expression of the adjacent gene, it just changes it by a small level or a small amount, and that really doesn't have an impact on fitness, and because it doesn't have an impact on fitness, it's not conserved. So another method is to look at chimeric enhancers. And this is what Misha Ludwig and Marty Kreitman did. There's not too many examples of this, but it is a good approach. So if you have a model where you have turnover of binding sites, these two sequences are functionally equivalent. They give the same output. However, if you chop them up right down here and take this half from this sequence and this half from the other sequence, then the output is two different products, one of which, of course, works and the other one doesn't. And so they showed a nice example of this for one of the Eve enhancers. Applying that across the genome would be difficult, but another area is to not just look at experimentally identified sites, but use sort of a comparative phylogenetic method to look at the gain, simultaneously look at the gain and loss of binding sites across multiple different organisms and somehow infer the rate of binding site gain or the rate of binding site loss or turnover. And that's a method that we've are an approach that we've tried to take, and other people have taken that as well. So just sort of empirically, if you look at a bunch of sequences and if you look for transcription factor binding sites, you can observe a variety of different patterns, say, here is a site that looks to be conserved, here's a site that's just present at one position, and then you have other sites that are present at multiple positions. And so the idea would be to look at the composite picture and infer how often you have sites that are gained and lost. The problem, of course, is that there's a lot of background, because transcription factor binding sites are short 5 to 8 base pairs. They're degenerate. Not every position is important. And so most transcription factor binding sites are expected to be found once per KB, once every couple KB. And so the fact that you observe them doesn't always mean that's actually a real site. Okay, so in order to look at patterns like this and test whether there is binding site turnover, whether there is gain and loss, you need an explicit model for the evolution of a binding site. And so I just wanted to go over some of the models that have been developed, and before getting to the data. So first, there has to be some relationship between, or it doesn't have to be, but there is an established relationship between sequence and binding affinity. And so there's a couple of papers that have done that looked at this quite a while ago and really did a nice job at sort of So a paper in 1986 by Schneider, and then a paper in 1987 by Berg and von Hippel, really sort of tried to define this relationship between sequence and binding affinity. And a lot of work since then has sort of established that we have a very good understanding of the relationship between sequence and binding affinity, and that's an important first step. That's not it. You have to assume some relationship between binding affinity and fitness. If binding doesn't matter, then it's just a neutral model. And so there's a couple of papers that have assumed it and sort of rationalized an explicit relationship. So Groland and Hua, and then these are just examples, but there are a number of other papers. These ones I put up here because they actually specifically addressed the relationship between binding affinity and fitness, and why the assumed relationship was, why they assumed one particular relationship. But very simply, it is assumed that the probability of being bound is a function of fitness. So if you need to respond to a particular environment, and the environment causes a change in the transcription factor, that if that sequence is bound by that transcription factor, then it allows you to respond to that environment. So it's a very simple relationship, although there could be other ones. And then finally, relating fitness to evolution or substitutions, we have a number of experts in the room. We've got I don't know his first name, but Berg, who worked with Michael There was a couple papers. I know. See, now that Michael's here, I got to get the dates right. 2003 and 2004. Villa had a paper in and he and Michael Lassig had a paper in 2005 where they. It's really not just fitness and evolution. It's really putting all of these components together, sort of from the beginning to the end, and then. Alan Moses also had a paper looking at the evolution of mining sites in sort of an explicit model in 2004. Okay, so all I've done is put up a number of references. I just wanted to give a very quick conceptual idea of how how these pieces get put together, and that just comes from a really sort of a simple equation for a single site. So what this equation describes is the sort of the flux of you have, let's say that you have four nucleotides at a site, and you have fitness for each one of those, and you want to know how those sites are going to evolve. Each of them have a different selection coefficient, and so if selection is very strong, nothing happens. You always have the same sequence, and you get mutations away from those, but those mutations never go anywhere because there's strong selection against them. However, if you have weak selection, every once in a while you'll have a mutation that is not optimal, but it'll become fixed in a population. And so one way to describe a model where you have weak selection, which is definitely the case for transcription factor binding sites, is the flux from nucleotide X to Y is equal to flux from nucleotide Y to X, and this is sort of an equilibrium state. So pi is the equilibrium frequency of base X, mu is the mutation rate from X to Y, and then F is the probability of fixation. So the amount of nucleotides that go from X to Y is equal to the equilibrium frequency, the mutation rate, times the probability of fixation. The probability of fixation depends on the strength of selection and the effective population size. And so the amount of the flux, or the probability of going from X to Y, is going to be equal to the probability of going from Y to X. The amount of change from X to Y is equal to the amount of change from Y to X at equilibrium, by definition. Okay, so I guess the from empirically, when we talk about binding sites and what we know about binding sites, people typically describe binding sites by position weight matrices, and position weight matrices are just basically an estimate of the equilibrium frequency of each base at each position within the binding site. So if you have, you know, a four base pair binding site and you have A, G, C, T, you can look at the frequency of at each base within that binding site. You can look at the frequency of the different nucleotides if you have a collection of binding sites. So if you go into the genome and identify 100 binding sites for this particular transcription factor, count up the number of A, G's, Z's, and T's, you've actually estimated the equilibrium frequency of those binding sites, assuming all of those binding sites are evolving under the same selective constraints. So with that estimate of the equilibrium frequency, that comes in here. Mutation rate we know a lot about. The probability of fixation is what we don't know. The probability of fixation is a function of the population size and the strength of selection. And since we don't know either of those with any certainty in most cases, it becomes a difficult problem. However, since we know the equilibrium frequencies and we know and we know something about the mutation rates, then this is the NS is the only unknown parameter, and so we don't need to know that. So I guess let me say a better way to put this. For any given transcription factor, the fitness determines the equilibrium base frequency. So if you know the equilibrium base frequencies, then you know within some error what the strength of selection is on that site. Once you know what the strength of selection is on that site, then you can model the evolution of that sequence. Okay. So maybe now would be a good time to take a coffee break and talk about the data. Just to recap, it is just very simple. We have a model, binding site turnover model, that could explain the fact that you've got a lot of sequence divergence without any divergence in function. So the regulation remains the same, but the sequence has changed a lot, and binding site model can turn over that, can explain that. So the question is, empirically, do we see binding sites being gained and lost between species? Not just any binding sites, but binding sites that are actually affecting fitness. And so the approach that we've used to look at that, and in order to conduct experiments, we wanted to look at individual binding sites. And so we look at a particular type of binding site where it's been conserved across some species but lost in others. And so the yeast species that we're looking at is four different yeast species and 91 different models of binding site models. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, Paradoxus, Micetae, and Bienus. These species are about as different at the nucleotide level as mammals are. And so, as I mentioned before, I mean, you can observe any sort of pattern. And so a particular pattern where you see something that looks like a binding site here and here but not in the other species, well, it could be due to chance. So the approach that we approach that we've taken is to use the fact that it's conserved between the most distantly related species to infer that the binding site actually is indeed conserved. Once you find a site that looks to be conserved, ask whether it's been lost on particular lineage. So in this case, it's really sort of a mixture of two models where the binding site has been evolving under a conserved model along these lineages, but then there's been a loss of constraint on one of those lineages, potentially due to the gain of another site. And so the way that we identified semi-conserved sites is we looked at all of these 91 binding site models, scanned through the genome, and identified sites that were evolving non-neutrally. So these have are significantly different from a neutral model. All of this really means is that it doesn't show neutral sequence evolution. So for these four different yeast species, there's about, the way we parameterize this, there's about 1.5 substitutions per site in synonymous positions in coding sequences. So we use this as an estimate of what the neutral rate of molecular evolution is, and given a model, or given a 1.5 substitutions per site, you can ask whether something that a sequence that looks like a binding site is significantly different than a neutral model. So we identified about 20,000 non-neutrally evolving sites. These are something that show just some evidence of constraint. And then out of those, we looked at those that fit a model where it's where the binding site's conserved across all lineages, and a model where there is what we call a semi-conserved model, where there's been conservation on some lineages, but then loss of constraint on others. And so the the formulation for these are based on the previous binding site models that I went over, but pretty much it's the probability of the data given the neutral model, where this is just sort of simple molecular evolution, molecular evolutionary model, probability of data given a conserved binding site model, and the probability of the data given a semi-conserved model. And for the semi-conserved model, we really only considered a couple of different possibilities. Although there's a lot of different possibilities, we considered cases where you could have loss of conservation along one of these tips. So let's see if I can get another color. So either here or here or here. We didn't consider loss in this most distantly related species, because if you allow loss here, there's a reasonable chance that you can see something that's conserved across these three lineages just by chance alone. So we wanted to require that the most distant species always had the binding site, because that provided a good indication that the binding site was functional. And so we allowed loss of constraint to occur at any position, at any point along this lineage, or this lineage, and integrated over those probabilities.
What you say, 91 binding site models, you mean like beta weight matrices for 91 constituent factors?
Yeah. Yeah, so the binding site models that we used actually come from a paper by Harbison in 2003 or 2004. Where they did chip on yeast using, I think, maybe more around 100 different transcription factors, identified all of the binding sites in the genome, and then they used a variety of different comparative genomics methods combined with this chip data to come up with position weight matrices for 91 transcription factors. So that's what we used.
Well, what's your take on them? And that they're obviously sort of a rather different quality. In some of them have many binding sites. It's statistically very well defined.
Yeah.
And then others, they're more question marks. So what's your take on that? How many?
My take home is that this is a serious problem. But I was gonna get to that in a little bit, but I think it's worth bringing up now, because you asked the question, and from the experimental data that we have, this is not the only collection. We just use this particular collection, but if you go back a couple years, there's a different collection of binding site models, and if you use those, you get a different answer. The answer in terms of the overall numbers that are semi-conserved, it doesn't really change a whole lot. However, the individual sites actually does change a lot. And that's a little bit disturbing, although there is some sort of statistical sort of, aspects that, you expect things not to change so much. But we looked at that just to get more directly. We looked at specific examples, because we tested a bunch of binding sites for MSN24, which is a stress response factor. And the model for that in this data is looks very similar to that model that the binding site model from another data set. You know, when you look at the two, they look very similar. However, when you run calculate the probability of the data under a conserved model or under a semi-conserved model, you get numbers that are different, and those differences make really end up changing what you defined as a conserved MSN24 site or a semi-conserved MSN24 site. The overlap, if you use a slightly different model for conserved sites, is pretty good. However, the overlap for semi-conserved sites is rather poor, and that's actually a problem. But it's actually not the only problem. So let me just, there's some experimental data that we collected, and it really sort of made us think about all of the other problems, this being one of them.
Can you go back a little bit? Because I think I don't quite understand how you got those 19,000 non-neutral sites.
Yeah. So what we did is, for each of these binding site models, we looked through the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, we looked through all of these genomes, and if we found one site in any of these genomes, we decided to test that for whether that site was evolving under a neutral model or not. And so the test for whether it was evolving under a neutral model is you would take the six base pairs that matched a binding site in one species, you know, requirement about whether it matches that site in the other species, and just calculate the likelihood of that data under a neutral model where you are expecting about 1.5 substitutions per site. And so all it's really saying is that it's non-neutral in all of these cases. It's in the direction that there are fewer substitutions than you would expect under a neutral model. Yeah?
So about your branch-specific model, so you only considered loss of constraint, right?
Yeah.
Branch specifically. So you don't, for example, look for a case where you have a binding site only in one branch and assume that it emerged there alone and not on the others?
No, I mean, you can write down the probabilities for that, but we just thought that, you know, in terms of actually doing the experiments to test this particular example was going to be the one where we'd have the most power to actually really say that this is not what you would expect just by random sequence changes. And so stuff like this should show up fairly often just by chance, either where you have two or species-specific binding sites. But there is information there, and we just didn't take that into account. But
and you used the sliding window for?
We scanned the entire all of the genome for all non-coding sequences for anything that looked like a binding site in one. We scanned the genome alignments for anything that looked like a binding site in any one of the four species.
Do you have any data on the expression levels in different species?
There have been some empirical studies of expression differences between these species, and the data were just coming out as we were doing this, and we actually had thought about one of the student who worked on this was Scott Doniger, and we actually thought about collecting these data because you could do species-specific microarrays. And there was some data that had come out on the time, and based on some preliminary analysis of that, we decided that it might not answer. We thought it might not answer the question because. Well, it was at the same time that we were doing some expression analysis of individual sites, and we were worried about a whole bunch of other things. So that kept us from collecting that data. Although that data is available, and there has been some analysis of what causes expression differences between species, and the group, I'm blanking on the name that did it, actually looked at our data to see if it explained expression differences between species, and absolutely explains nothing. So,
in the model, you will assume that the function is conserved. actually. And
yeah.
That as loss, you will assume that the expression level is the same in most form.
Well, there could be other differences in the promoter. So if you have a conserved site, then we would say that, yeah, that aspect of expression should be conserved. But there could be other binding sites that are being gained and lost that could cause differences. So I think the best case would be to look for when you see loss and then ask whether the species that shows loss, does that have a change in expression? So let me talk about the experiments, because that's some of the data that we did collect. And so we wanted to test whether, you know, when we see something that looks like loss of a binding site, does that actually cause a change in expression, which is what you're asking. But before I do that, I want to tell you about some other experiments that we had done in earlier work, and those involved five UMe6 and four NBT80 binding sites. So these are two meiosis-specific transcription factors, and we identified, we scanned for the genome and looked for NDT80 and UMe6 sites, as well as a whole bunch of other things that were significantly conserved. And we tested these nine sites. They are significant. Well, the sites that we tested are significantly conserved. So the probability of that site being conserved under a neutral model is low, less than 1%. So we wanted to say, okay, if this is really a conserved NDT80 site, if it's a conserved UMe6 site, if you put a mutation in that site, you should affect expression. So the experiment that we did, actually in this case, we were just using the three species. Is we look for a conserved site, and we took the Saccharomyces cerevisiae promoter, and we put it in front of a reporter gene, and we compared expression of wild type to a mutant promoter. So in this case, our reporter was beta-galactosidase. We took the wild-type construct, that should just have the regular expression, and then we made either two or three substitutions in the binding site that would definitely eliminate all remnants of that binding site. And we asked whether there were significant changes in expression between this construct compared to this construct. And so the results from these is 8 out of the 9 sites showed significant changes in gene expression. One, I think, really important control that we did for this is that you could say, well, you know, if you do enough replicates, any nucleotide substitution is going to cause a change in expression. So what we did was we also compared the expression of these two constructs in cells lacking the UMe6 protein and lacking NDT80. So these are deletion strains where UMe6 has been deleted and NDT80 has been deleted. And then those strains, there is no difference between these two constructs. So the control, so the definition here for the 8 out of the 9 were successfully predicted is that there's an expression difference in a wild type genetic background, but no difference in expression if you delete UMe6 or NDT80. So based on the success of that experiment, we thought we were also going to do well in predicting semi-conserved sites, and that turned out not to be true. So we tested 11 sites, and 3 out of 11 turned out to be true using the same test. So these are 6 MSN24 binding sites, three ROCS1 sites, and 2 NDT80 sites. So the experiment that we did here was similar, and this case, there's loss of a binding site. And there's really, if you observe a pattern like this, there's two experiments you could do. One is you could disrupt this site and say, okay, if that's a real site, you should affect expression. The other would be to recreate the site here and see if that affects expression. We decided to do this experiment. It's a little bit simpler. It's also the first step. And given our results, we actually didn't we didn't go further to sort of look at the expression in from the other species constructs. So in this case, it's just doing the same experiment where we take a semi-conserved site where we see loss in one species, and we take Cerevisiae case where it's actually been conserved here, and then we compare wild type and mutant, and we find, as opposed to this case where we find 8 out of 9, here we find only 3 out of the 11 show significant differences in expression in the presence of the protein, but no differences in expression in the absence of the protein. A couple things to point out, actually, 2 out of the 11 showed significant differences, I believe it's both in the presence and the absence of the protein. So they affected expression, it just wasn't specific to these transcription factors. And so there's a number of other sort of caveats to in general our approach. So interpretations and inclusions. First of all, alignment is a significant concern. If this species has been misaligned, then you can actually misinfer things. I think this was actually something that we had a pretty good handle on because we did local realignments based on the transcription factor prediction. So if a transcription factor was actually predicted to bind right here, we locally realigned this. We tried to get the best alignment. The issue that Michael raised is all of these modeling and probabilistic calculations start with the assumption that you know the binding site model. In other words, you have a position weight matrix, and that's true. And if it's true, then you can make all of these calculations. They're estimates of the truth, and incorporating error into this is an estimate of the true position weight matrix. It's only an estimate, and we didn't incorporate that in uncertainty. And so, if you take different position weight matrices made from different people, you get different results, and that's not really an optimum approach to modeling binding sites and to doing these experiments because it's a certain amount of uncertainty there. But I think this is definitely an important issue. Another problem is the assumption that all binding sites are equal. So, you know, you say, well, there's, you know, maybe 100 NDTAD or 100 UME6 sites in the genome, and the assumption is that they're all basically evolving under the same evolutionary model. They're under the same constraints. There is examples where this is not the case. So in some cases, you might want a really strong UME6 binding site, where in other cases, you might want a moderately strong UME6 binding site or a weak binding site. Actually, some of the early work on promoters has shown that there are substitutions that can increase the binding of at the Tata box, and that's actually disadvantageous because you can't actually leave the Tata box to start transcription. So if you bind too tightly, that can be a bad thing. And given those examples, this assumption is it's important to think about that. Then, as I talked about at the beginning, these models all assume independence among sites. This is something that Michael and other people that he's worked with have made this point about binding sites, is that if you have a substitution at one particular position in a binding site, the probability of that going to fixation should depend on the other sequences at the rest of the positions in the binding site. So a position might be tolerated for some examples of a binding site and not tolerated for other examples, and this isn't accounted for in the modeling. Although to a first order approximation, maybe it works okay, but. Then there's these issues about the expression data. So one of the things we don't know when we test a site for whether it affects expression, are we measuring under the right condition? So UME6 and NDT80, we know that they function during sporulation. So obviously you measure expression during sporulation. This is a stress response factor. This is a factor that responds to hypoxic conditions. And this is meiosis. So we have an idea of where to look, but just because we don't observe an expression difference doesn't mean that there will be a difference at another particular, under another condition. Even if you get the condition right, you might not get the time right. So when do you look at when do you look for an expression difference? Is this just, is it at the, time is another factor that you can only look at levels at a certain number of times. And then there's also a question of whether actually looking at expression levels is what the is actually what should be looked at. I mean, looking at the binding of a transcription factor to a site does affect levels, but it could also affect the dynamics of the regulation. So it might come on earlier, it might come on later. All of these variables are often not known, and so there are many cases where if you don't see an expression change when you mutate a site that has been conserved, that doesn't mean that that site doesn't affect fitness. You might just not have looked under the appropriate conditions. Okay, so I guess the conclusions that I'd like, or that sort of the take home that I'd like to give for this, is that very sort of interesting observation that I think is general, where you have these sequences that are doing the same things, but we haven't been able to figure out their obvious the relationships between them. However, the cell machinery certainly does. And a model binding site turnover can explain this and supposes that we should see turnover. And I think our data are consistent with binding site turnover, although I think there's basically what we've really done is shown that we need to improve our models and a lot in order to get really sort of more accurate estimates of how frequent binding site turnover does occur over short evolutionary time points. If we can get good estimates of that, then we can say, okay, is that enough to explain the fact that after a very long time, promoters look nothing like, you can't even align them. So for the next part, I wanted to talk about what I call, and what it's actually a colleague of mine at the genetics department who has done, he and his student have done some interesting work on this, the dark matter of the genome. And maybe other people have call other things in the genome dark matter, or there's other words, but let me just tell you what I mean. Okay. So So I'll just use yeast as an example, but there's similar observations in other organisms. So in yeast, if you look at the substitution rate in non-coding sequences, and you compare that to the substitution rate and at synonymous sites, you can estimate the amount of constraint on non-coding sequences. And these estimates are about 30 to 40% of non-coding sequences are constrained. So in other words, the substitution rate in non-coding sequences is about 60% of what you find at synonymous sites. So the inference is that, well, either the mutation rate is lower in non-coding sequences, which is unlikely, or there's 30 to 40%, that's where the 40% number comes from, but different studies are slightly different, 30% or 40% of non-coding sequences are constrained. This does not agree with experimental data. So there's been a lot of promoters that have been studied in yeast. Yeast typically have 500 base pair energetic sequences. They're pretty easy to study. And when you do that, usually you get 2 to 5 binding sites per promoter. Binding sites are 6 to 8 base pairs. You're usually talking about less than 50 base pairs out of 500 base pairs. So if you look at sort of experimental examples, we have a reason to believe that about 50 base pairs of sequence should be conserved for a promoter. However, when you look across genomes and you estimate how much actually is conserved, you find that the number is quite a bit higher, hundreds of base pairs. And so to look at this, one possible explanation is maybe you just have lots of binding site turnover, and so, you know, if you experimentally identify 2 to 5 binding sites in the next species up, or the down, or whichever way you're going, it might be slightly different. You know, if some of those positions have been changed and those change enough, you could explain this. And that's probably not true. So what we did is we looked at all of the yeast genome. And this was from an earlier paper where we had actually used as many models of binding sites as we could. So we used 160 different models of binding sites. And we think we're looking at most transcription factors. There's a model for most transcription factors. And at most, if you look for all conserved instances of these binding sites, at most you can explain 17% of energetic sequences in yeast. So this is about half of what is conserved between species. So I'll see if I can open this up and just show one example. Okay, so I think you can see it a little bit, but this is an alignment of the 4 different yeast species starting and then just continuing down. And then we look for conserved binding sites, and those are annotated above the alignment by letters. And when it's conserved, it's indicated in red. So you have a sequence that's conserved up here, and we found binding sites that match. We found 4 different binding sites that match this conserved sequence. They actually overlap with each other. Here we found something that binding site that that is conserved in three of the four species. And so this whole thing is just simply colorings. This is not complicated at all. It's all it is taking binding sites and say, is there a match or not? So it's very simple binary model, no evolutionary model. And is that match present in three out of the four species? And so you're finding matches to these conserved sequences, to these conserved sequences. However, you often find sequences like this, where there is significant conservation, as indicated by the stars, but no binding site model that matches that. And so, actually looking at this example, you would say, well, probably you just don't have the right model for this. And there's a way that you can address that, which is Ting Wang and Gary Stermo's lab developed a binding site prediction model where you actually, one of the steps in that model is to actually take a sequence alignment like this and make a profile of that sequence, search the genome for any other sequences that have this profile, and do this iteratively to come up with binding sites. And it puts it all together, and then it comes out with all of these predictions. But that being one of the step, we've used that to take, sort of, for instance, take this sequence and look and ask whether there are any other sequences that are in the non-coding region of the genome that look like this. And we haven't done this systematically, but there are many examples of what I guess can be inferred as uniquely conserved non-coding sequences. So it's possible that the reason that 40% of non-coding sequences are constrained, but only half of them can be explained by binding sites, is not because there are other binding sites that we haven't found, but because there are other sequences that are conserved, they are uniquely conserved, and I don't know of any really good sort of model to explain this data.
So are you including nucleosome binding sites and stuff like that? Because you can even now, they have done extensive studies in yeast, and you can kind of download a map on top of this, which tells you the prediction. So is there a correlation between this dark matter and the predictive nucleosome?
I don't know if that's a correlation, but I would expect, although maybe this is not true, that nucleosome positioning sites would be repeated within the genome. So if it's like a string of A's or a string of A's or T's, that you would find multiple instances.
Right. So I didn't mean exactly the binding site, but just the region that they cover. So maybe there's just a correlation between being occupied by that.
Definitely possible. But still, you would imagine that there would have to be some sort of physical interaction. Otherwise, why would each individual site be conserved? And so if there was a physical interaction, you can't imagine that there are, you know, 6,000... I mean, maybe there's enough physical interactions where each promoter has a different, conserved spacing region that matches up in a different part of the nucleosome, and it wraps around in a particular way that would make it conserved but uniquely conserved. But I think those are the types of things that we need to think about in order to understand the evolution of cis-regulatory sequences. Basically, the point is that binding sites are only half the story, at least the canonical binding sites that I've been talking about and that a lot of us, I think about when modeling regulatory sequences. The fact that they are uniquely conserved makes it particularly difficult because it's hard to say what model they're evolving on. Just to give you a general... We haven't quantified it, so we haven't. I mean, just going by examples where we've sort of taken these, when we look for them, I think most of them are, unless you're talking about strings of A's and T's, which generally are excluded from binding site models but can be conserved. If you look at stuff like this, you don't find any examples of something of a sequence like this conserved elsewhere in the genome. You might maybe 10 or 20% of the time you'll find a couple of matches that look moderately similar. So maybe, you know, 3 or 4 of the positions out of the 8 look to be something, and then you could say, well, maybe that is just a binding site that we haven't found, or an alternative version of a binding site that we know about.
Did you do any experiments like the kind that you talked before for this?
No, but that would be that. That's our, so. One of the, my colleagues, Rob Mitra, has a student that's looking into this experimentally, basically saturation mutagenesis of a promoter region, and looking at the effects on expression. So I think experiments like that will really sort of help address these.
We know that the binding sites, they're sort of more concentrated, say, in the first 150 base pairs from the transcription start site. Is that true for these unique matches or this dark matter as well, or is it more or less evenly distributed over these promoters?
We haven't looked at the distribution, but that would be, I mean, that would obviously could be very informative, particularly with the nucleosome positioning data in terms of trying to generate some hypotheses. But, you know, even that, you know, binding sites usually occurring within the first 50 to 200 base pairs of the promoter, you know, there are still a lot of binding sites that have experimentally identified that are like 500 base pairs from the promoter. I think these conserved sequences, I haven't noticed any trend. But when I look at stuff like this and you just sort of annotate conserved binding sites, I don't see a trend towards occurring on at the, you know, this is the start site down here, or occurring over here. Of course, there's another gene, and a lot of times it's going in the other direction, and so, you know, that whole sort of positioning effect is not always clear.
I agree. I mean, this is something that we can see, like, more like counting many. It's some relatively subtle statistics, but that could be something relatively easy to do for this.
I think that's. And that would be.
To see whether they would. Maybe it's sort of just. I'm not even sure whether it's that terribly informative, but maybe since these first 150 base pairs may be more or less packed with binding sites, then maybe the rest of stuff is automatically in the rest, but not for some functional reason, just because it's sort of, it's the rest. But it would still be interesting to see how that is distributed.
Yeah, so this phylonet algorithm, which sort of, you know, you can input a sequence and then it gives you a set of alignments, sort of using a BLAST-like scoring algorithm to give you all of the other sequences, is a good way to define how uniquely conserved a sequence is. And so, you know, applying that, we could come up with a list of sort of potentially uniquely conserved sites. I think the one thing that this you know further illustrates is that for a binding site turnover model to explain the lack of sequence similarity between distant species that have the same expression pattern, when you look at closely related species, the estimate is that 40% of sites are conserved at some level. And so with all of that sequence conservation, how is the function, I mean, you know, if function is determined by a small number of binding sites, or even if it's like, you know, 5 to 10 binding sites in a 1 kb region, that's still a relatively small amount of bases that you can gain and lose binding sites within. However, 50% of bases in that region are actually doing something. There's not much room for compensatory evolution and turnover. These are speculations, but I think this is sort of, this adds to the any model that explains you know, sequence divergence with functional conservation of gene expression should also account for this observation that, 30 to 40% of intergenic sequences are conserved. Okay. So we usually stop at noon. This is probably a good stopping point. There was a couple other things I had to say about quantitative traits, but it really deserves an introduction. So I think maybe either another time or over coffee or lunch or something like that. So.